What communities around the world need most right now to withstand climate change? Why every euro in climate finance matters, and why investing in climate is investing in people. This and more you will hear in this episode.
Your money can do more than you think. It can help protect the climate, support biodiversity, and empower women around the world. Karen and Sina from EukoCredit take you on a journey in their podcast Ethics and Euros. From coffee farms in Peru to solar energy projects in India, you'll discover the real impact your money can have. Your money, your choice. Tune in now.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of EukoCredit's podcast Ethics and Euros. My name is Sina, and today we will talk about climate and why every euro counts when it comes to resilience against climate crisis. Who could be a better guest for this topic than James Todd, our head of climate and community resilience at EukoCredit? Climate finance is still a small but steadily growing area of activity for EukoCredit, and one that is becoming increasingly important. So welcome, James Todd.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here, James. Would you like to introduce yourself briefly? Like, who are you? What do you do at EukoCredit?
Absolutely. So I'm James. I've been with EukoCredit now for close to 10 years, and I'm currently leading our climate and community resilience work. And so the team that I lead is investing in practical, affordable climate solutions that are helping people in low incomes to adapt, save money, and build stronger livelihoods.
And how did you get into this field? What motivates you to work there?
That's a good question. Well, really, I started in renewable energy investments with EukoCredit quite some time ago. And climate is a bit of an extension of beyond renewable energy and energy access. So it was taking some of those technical skills, but also just an interest in beyond the technical solutions. What does it mean? How do we create impact? And how do we look at things without looking in silos like we typically do in terms of energy or agriculture, for example, or financial inclusion? It's more, what is the impact? What is the solution for end beneficiaries? Because climate touches on everything. And so it really kind of came out of my experiences in renewable energy and wanting to see that as an enabler to a broader impact.
You're head of climate and community resilience. Could you explain in simple words, what is community resilience?
Yes. So community resilience is the community's ability to prepare for, withstand, and bounce back from shocks, things like droughts or even grid blackouts, and to come back stronger. So for what this practically means for us is financing climate smart solutions that are keeping clinics open, food fresh, small businesses running, even when conditions are tough. So you could think of a solar-powered mini-grid with battery storage that is then replacing diesel. So a lot of communities are running power, if they have power, on diesel generators. And so if you're having a solar-powered solution with battery storage that is replacing the diesel, it also keeps the local mill open, the local clinic open, and shops running. It lowers costs, cuts emissions, helps to improve and sustain health and study hours, and creates jobs. So that's the kind of practical resilience we're trying to finance.
These smart or power grids, what do they look like? What is the technical beneficial thing? It sounds quite small, right? It's like a small thing providing a lot of power?
Yes. So it would be a small array of solar panels and batteries, which are, they can either power people's homes or they can power small businesses. So that could be lighting, it could be productive equipment, so it could be drilling, for example, or electric milling and threshers. It could also be cold storage, so not just helping with the processing of crops, but actually keeping them fresh once they've been harvested, for example. It could also be powering community boreholes for clean water or small-scale irrigation solutions to help with yields and just making sure there is a climate resilient agricultural solution. So those are the types of interventions that a mini grid can support.
That already sounds like a pretty smart solution. Can you say, when did you first realize what kind of impact community resilience can have?
Yeah, I think that was really the work that we were doing in the mini-grid sector. And so just to elaborate on a mini-grid briefly, you can think of that as a small group of solar panels and batteries with some poles and cables and wiring can connect a rural community that is off-grid. Maybe they're 10, 15, 20 kilometers from the national grid. And maybe they have access to diesel generators, or maybe they have very little energy whatsoever. But through the solar panels and the inverters and the technical equipment, a mini-grid can provide an entire community of several hundred people and small businesses. They can provide them with access to clean, reliable, and affordable energy. And it was really going in and doing due diligence on those types of projects in different countries that made me realize that, yes, that's a solution, that's a technical solution, but bringing energy is just one part of the solution. You need to understand the dynamics of that community. You need to understand the economics of that community. And then you need to provide solutions which are community-led as well. So not top-down, but really engaging with communities, understanding what they need and what they need now, what they will need in the future. So it's a much more holistic intervention than just bringing energy access to a community. And that's where it came from.
Thank you. Can you say clearly what is the connection between climate and community resilience for you?
Yeah, I mean, climate touches on everything, right? It's a very blanket term. But I think what we need to unpackage really what it means for us at OICO Credit. So it touches on everything that we finance. So whether it is providing energy access for small, medium-sized enterprises, whether it is powering agricultural solutions, whether it's powering community services, so whether that's schools or clinics or lighting in rural communities, that's really what we mean by climate, so a climate resilient infrastructure. So what we've done is we've established a strategy which tries to generate climate resilient solutions across four key pillars. And that's the infrastructure side, what I've been touching on up until now, things like mini grids, commercial and industrial solar solutions, making sure that there's productive equipment which is being powered by renewable energy. So it's helping to generate income and improve efficiency. So that's one side. You've got sustainable food systems. So that is water efficiency, reduced food loss, regenerative agricultural practices. You have carbon finance, which is looking at solutions like biochar, for example, where carbon offsets are directly benefiting smallholder farmers. And then there's a final part, which is ecosystem enablers, which is looking at platforms that and innovative financing solutions, which are really trying to channel additional finance and data towards climate SMEs and really helping those smaller organizations, which are the backbone of many economies, providing them with the right types of solutions that set them up for success.
So we're providing them with loans. Why did OICO Credit decide to focus more on climate finance?
Well, we're providing them with loans and also equity investments as well. The majority is loans. But why are we focusing on climate finance? Because the opportunity and also the need are both huge. So the climate crisis is intensifying. We can see that. We can see that with recent events across the globe. In Kenya, for example, I was reading about floods in the recent weeks, which have killed 66 people in Nairobi, for example. And we've seen it throughout 2025. There were more than 200 different climate-related disasters. So the climate crisis is intensifying. And low-income communities, women, smallholder farmers, they are the ones that are disproportionately affected. And so there's a massive financing gap for practical solutions that we're trying to support in emerging markets. So I think with OICO Credit, we can bring flexible, impact-led capital to enable those types of organizations and solutions to scale responsibly.
You already addressed floods now. What climate risks do you see most prominently in our partner regions? So Africa, South America, Asia, is it floods? Are there some more?
The obvious examples, which are the exposure to extreme weather events, So floods and droughts, for example. But there are other secondary effects as well. So things like water stress, soil degradation, which impacts food security and it impacts incomes of smallholder farms, and energy insecurity as well. So a lot of the time, the energy grid infrastructure in a lot of these countries is unreliable and very expensive. And that leads to, well, those costs are passed on to the end consumer. And I think the energy access is really the backbone of development. So that has a further knock-on effect. So really, I'd say there's the obvious exposure to extreme weather, but also water stress, soil degradation, and energy insecurity are some of the other risks that we see.
What would you say? How do the needs of low-income communities differ from those of communities in high-income countries?
That's a good question. I think we need to focus on that there's too often we take a lot of things for granted. And I think when you really try to place yourself in the context of low-income communities in developing countries, they need access to reliable, affordable basics. So whether that's power, whether that's water, whether that is cold storage, whether that's even mobility, for example, just the going from A to B, or getting their produce from A to B, they need access to those basics. And that needs to be done in an economically and environmentally sustainable way so that they can keep working, learning, and earning through climate shocks, because they're going to be the ones that are most impacted. And so a lot of the infrastructure that is in place in high-income contexts that's already been there, it needs to be reinvested in, but a lot of it is already there. And what we're talking about is really bringing developing countries, having kind of a leapfrog, and doing that in a decentralized way and not the typical way that it's been done in developed Western countries, for example. So that needs different financing solutions as well as different practical solutions that are immediately generating savings and additional income from day one. So it's a very different context from developed markets.
What would you say? Do you think that all sectors of eco-credits, are not only agriculture, but also microfinance and, of course, renewable energy, but do all of them, all of these areas, are they connected to climate? What would you say?
Yes. I mean, as I said before, I think climate really touches on everything. We tend to think in these different pillars, financial inclusion, agriculture, renewable energy. But at the end of the day, we're talking about the impact on people, and they don't necessarily see it in that context. We're talking about people without access to infrastructure that will help them be resilient in the future against extreme heat, for example, or drought or flooding. And yeah, that's whether we look at that through a loan from a financial institution or whether we see them as smallholder farmers and we're trying to finance trade flows, or whether we're trying to bring to them a renewable energy solution. I think this is why we're kind of transitioning more to climate, because it's more of a holistic view of the impact that's needed and the impact that's needed for the end beneficiary, as opposed to just focusing on solutions in different silos.
Absolutely. Could you provide us two different examples? What would you say, like projects that EcoCredit finances?
Yes, so maybe I'd focus on one being water smart agriculture. So one set of projects that we're looking at are solar irrigation and efficient processing. So this will be financing the distribution of solar water pumps, and also then trying to combine that with cold storage solutions. And so in that way, what we're doing is we're hoping to save water usage, reduce losses at the primary production side of farming. But also once the harvest is taking place, if we're also financing a cold storage unit, for example, where farmers can bring their harvest and store it for a period of time to extend the shelf life, that means that they can find the best price. They can find other routes to market or different markets, which then raises their incomes. It prevents the wastage, so it prevents also emissions, and it strengthens food security. So that's water smart agriculture combined with a cold storage, and that's something that's really important from just focusing on smallholder farming in general. So that's maybe one. And then another one, going back to my renewable energy days, I think decentralized clean energy for SMEs. So again, this is solar panels and batteries for businesses. I think that's really important that we have as something which is reliable, that businesses can plan around, that is cutting the use of fossil fuels, and that is often priced in a way which is less than what you would pay to the national grid. And it can also create local jobs for technicians, for maintenance of those assets. And even if you have a mini grid in place, for example, and you're able to then have a charging infrastructure in place, as one of our partners has a mini grid in place, and then they have an arrangement with a major European auto manufacturer, and they're piloting e-tractors, and the tractors then charged off of the mini grid. And then you have access to this high-end e-tractors in a rural setting, and that's saving costs and also creating jobs again in the smallholder sector. So that's kind of maybe a crossover of the two.
Nice examples. Thank you very much. When I've been to India, I've also seen that a lot of the harvest is going mold before they actually can bring it to the market, right? So it's also economically, it's like not only sustainably, but also economically like really bad for them as well.
Yes, absolutely.
So is it these kind of projects that you would say that have the greatest or biggest impact climate related and also socially? Or are there any other examples you would say that have the biggest impact?
No, I think the projects where we're really, again, breaking down those silos and we're saying, okay, this is a solution which is providing productive equipment. It's combining regenerative agricultural practices. Those are assets which are also, you need to finance in a long-term way. And I think those are the ones where you know that it's going to be, if it's implemented correctly, it's going to be in the community for a long period of time. And you see the benefits almost instantly. So those are the ones which have the biggest climate and social impact. But they're also very challenging to try and finance. We could discuss that later if you want. But yes, there's certainly the highest impact when you're combining energy access, regenerative agriculture, routes to market. Then you're really starting to think in terms of what the end impact is and how you're amplifying that as much as you possibly can.
Why are they most difficult to finance? You can talk to us now if you want.
So often those types of projects need longer term debt or even concessional capital. And sometimes you need to blend in different layers of capital, guarantees, for example. And you need to have an organization which has the technical know-how to be able to implement that solution and monitor that solution and maintain that solution. So you're looking for quite a lot of expertise. You're looking for an organization that can have the right type of financing in place, that can speak to customers, who would be for them, really understand their needs, have the digital and payment infrastructure in place to make it economic for them, and run these assets long-term with a quite a large upfront cost. So to actually procure these solutions and put them in place, a lot of the cost is upfront, and then you're getting a payback over multiple years. And you really need the right type of understanding finance partners and the right type of donor funding and guarantees and concessional capital to be able to make that a reality. And once you get over that valley of death, as it were, then you can scale and you can have huge impact. But it's much easier said than done.
Yeah, but that's what we're working for more than 50
Absolutely.
Years now, right? The impact. What role do the local partners play in this work, actually?
Yeah, so I mean, they're absolutely key. Selecting the right types of companies and partners to work with, yeah, that's really key. So we need to really work with organizations, and I think partner is the right word, really partner with those organizations that are originating projects, they're operating assets, they're serving customers, they're trying to build and maintain trust, and they need to have various areas of expertise, as I just said, and we need to be able to understand the challenges that they're facing, not just the technical solution and the community solution, but often it goes into national planning also just the legal infrastructure, regulatory constraints. There's a lot that is on their plate. So we need to be there to support them whilst protecting investors' capital. And for that, we really need to know the local markets. And that's also why we have a setup where we have a centralized team with certain structuring expertise, and we try and work as much as possible with the regions and regional investment offices who are close to the local partners and really understand the transactions and monitor the transactions and work with those organizations to understand the impact and ensure that impact takes place.
That's why it's also so important for us to have these regional officers working for Oiko Credit in the countries we're giving the loans and having the equity investments, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Looking into the future, what would you wish for from our investor community, like today and in the years to come?
That's a great question. Maybe I'd boil it down to two things, and it relates to what I've said in the past. But I think what's really needed from us is we need investors that can stay the course with patient capital so that we can finance these types of assets that communities are going to rely on for decades. So we need to identify the partners, and we need to work with the partners, and we need to structure the financing the right way for end beneficiaries, for communities. But we also need an investor base, and we have an investor base, but we also need it to stay that way as well, that we have investors that, as I said, stay the course and understand that patient capital is needed to really create the impact that we're striving for. And then just to build on that, maybe I think the second part is we need some help and support in terms of crowding in blended finance. So a lot of these solutions, we're talking about community infrastructure, and there's a lot of discussion and conversations around, is that the role of our type of capital or private capital to try and finance those types of assets? And you cannot argue that actually that's the role of public funding. And I think it's a bit more nuanced. So what we need is we need guarantees and first loss funding from multilateral institutions, from the EFIs, from the World Bank, organizations like that, in order to unlock the scale that's needed in these markets to bring the right type of impact in a responsible way. So yeah, maybe to summarize, it's a long answer. So maybe to summarize, stay the course with us with patient capital, because it really is impactful and we can demonstrate that impact. And also help us through your network and just your engagement with decision makers in the public sector. Help us to try and crowd in blended finance as well.
How do you think climate and community resilience at Oiko Credit will develop in the next 10 years, and which focus will Oiko Credit have?
Yeah, so I've written a pretty extensive strategy paper on what we're going to be doing until 2030. So maybe I could speak about how we plan to build up the portfolio from a climate perspective until 2030. So it really is a calm, considered build-up, because a lot of the way of financing these projects is they're still developing. As we can see in the world, there's a lot of pulling back on commitments to climate, a lot of climate skepticism, but the climate crisis is increasing every day. So it really is staying the course in that storm and anchoring the portfolio with lower risk, climate resilient infrastructure. Those are transactions which have a more standard way of financing. They tend to be lower risk and have access to some of the guarantees that I was talking about. And then look to build up more of our exposure in sustainable food systems. So this is solar water pumps, cold storage, those types of solutions. And so that will be the focus 26, 27, 2028. And then going more towards 2030, we need to really try and understand more about carbon finance. That's an enormous potential. There's a lot of noise around it. So we need to take our time to make sure that we understand that market properly. We're not going to claim any impact which cannot be demonstrated. We don't want to, you know, we're very cautious around that. We want to be very cognizant about the role that our capital is playing with respect to carbon finance. And it needs to be really linked to impact in a transparent way. And then at the same time, we need to keep our ear close to the ground to understand what are some of the rapidly developing ways of crowding climate finance in. And that's one pillar where we talk about ecosystem enablers, where we're trying to channel capital into innovative financing solutions or innovative climate smart solutions. And that is a bit more opportunistic. So yeah, that's there, kind of in the I would say in the background, but it's there at the same time as we're trying to expand climate resilient infrastructure and sustainable food systems.
Thank you. What do communities around the world need most right now to withstand climate change, and how can we as investors contribute?
Similar to what I said before, they need reliable essentials, so the power, water, cooling, mobility, and. Yeah, and I think how we contribute is just making sure that we operate with the right partners and that we provide the financing solution to the partners in the right way, which can be passed on to end clients and to low-income communities, so that we're not burdening them with the funding that we're providing for these assets.
And why is now the right moment for our investors to consider topping up their investment?
There's a lot of skepticism and there's a lot of noise out there right now, particularly since the beginning of last year. And at the same time, the cost of inaction is rising every day and there are impact-ready opportunities that exist today. So I believe that by getting additional funding in place, that is going to really help us to bridge the climate finance gap, which is only widening every day in underserved markets. So we need that capital to block out the noise, to focus on those that need it most, to scale projects with measurable social climate benefits, and to do that in an economically responsible way.
And even small amounts are helpful, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I intend this in a certain way. I hope this doesn't come across as cheesy, but I think that investing in climate is investing in people. So when a clinic is staying powered, when a harvest is being protected, when a small business is cutting energy costs, that's climate action, making life better today, and it's more making it more resilient in the future. So even if it's a small amount, it's a contribution towards that. And I think that's what we should be aiming for.
Absolutely. We're coming closer to the end of this episode. What have you personally learned from your work at Oiko Credit?
Ooh, a lot. So I started in the banking sector, in structured finance in a commercial bank. And it's very different from trying to provide climate solutions in developing markets. So you need to take certain fundamental finance principles and you need to adapt them where appropriate. And why do you need to adapt them? Yes, okay, there's the legal and regulatory and security structure is different, but also the way of reaching people with that funding is completely different. You're not just focused on trying to finance a company that's offering products and services. You're trying to demonstrate that the funding that you provide through this company is really impacting people for good and doing that in a way which is safeguarding investors' capital. And it's really not very easy. I think everyone would be doing it if it was easy. So I've learned a lot about just resilience, patience, creativity, and never losing sight of what we're doing this for. I could go and work for a commercial bank and provide funding to different companies, but what are we doing this for? We're doing this to have a social and an environmental impact and to make the world better on with each partner that we engage with.
And if you could give our listeners one key message, what would it be?
I don't want to repeat myself, but I think investing in climate is investing in people. So even if it is a small amount that you would be looking to invest in via Oiko Credit, just know that we are an organization which truly cares about delivering conscious, tangible impact. And also cares about trying to do that in a sustainable way. So environmentally sustainable, but also economically sustainable. And that goes through every one of the people that I interact with on a daily basis in our organization. And you see that with all the people that are in the regions interacting with the projects directly as well. So Yeah, maybe that's the takeaway, is that there is a lot of goodwill, energy, expertise, that we're trying to do things in the right way. And I believe that we've made a lot of impact in 50 years, and we need your capital to continue to do that, and to do that in an even smarter way for the coming years, because the issues out there are very big, and we need to put our efforts in the right place to make sure that they're resolved.
Thank you very much, James, for all your great input. I think we learned a lot about all the connection between climate and community resilience, how Oikocredit is connected with it, and what are we working for to also try to close or make it at least a bit smaller, the financial gap that is there out there about the climate finance. And I think it's not cheesy. I think it's actually really connected to our mission and vision that investing in climate is investing in people. Thank you very much. It was great to talk to you, James. Goodbye.
Thank you very much for your time.
In our next episode, Karen is in Brazil at the moment and is going to visit one of our partner organizations. So you will have some more content about our partners as well in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good day. Goodbye.